Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When investment performance matters, make sure your savings are with Zurich. Visit zurich.ie to find out more.
The city of Dnipro in central Ukraine was bombed for the first time in the early hours of this morning. One person was killed in the airstrike that hit a preschool, an apartment building and a shoe factory, according to the emergency services there. Well, in a moment we'll hear from Hamish de Breton-Gordon, who's a former British military commander and a chemical weapons expert. But first, journalist Katerina Malofieva joins us now from Dnipro, and you're very welcome to the programme, Katerina, this evening. As I say, this was the first instance of shelling on Dnipro. Can you tell us what happened exactly at 6:10 a.m. this morning?
Good evening. First of all, I had a call from the hotel where I'm staying, telling me that, asking me politely to go down to the basement. And truth be told, you know, the sirens, air raid sirens, they go for a week already. And people, because so far there hasn't been any attack, so people kind of ignore this. But at the reception, they told me that there was several explosions in the morning. So I checked, of course, obviously, immediately on the social networks, and I got the confirmation. And of course, I felt quite scared, because this is the first time. You know, you never know where the explosions are happening and whether they will come somewhere closer to you. Mm. So eventually I went on a site and I saw the results of the shelling with my own eyes.
Were there any military targets in the area?
According to the civilians and to the police that we talked to, there were no any military facilities around. These three explosions took place in the area of industrial area. There is a coal chemical plant, there is a heavy machinery plant, but as a result, the shoe plant, small shoe factory, was destroyed completely, and the nearby residential blocks were shelled. Also, the windows of the school and the kindergarten nearby were blown out. There were no military facilities.
I know that Dnipro in recent weeks has become somewhat of a safe place for people who are fleeing Kharkiv and the surrounding areas, but it's no longer a safe place, is it?
It is no longer a safe place, and I was able to talk to civilians today at the main railway station departing from Dnipro. Some of them were crying. They're crying because they felt it was safe in Dnipro. They never imagined it would happen in Dnipro. They told me that this is a nightmare. You know, they were crying, carrying their pets with them. You know, they were thinking to leave to the west of Ukraine, but at the same time they don't know where they were going. There are free of charge tickets by the Ukrainian railway to the west of the country, to Lviv, to Chop, but many of those people, they don't know actually where they're going and what they will, where they will can find the refuge, basically.
So what are people doing then? I believe in the metro, people are setting up temporary homes. It's very cold there. There's queues at the train station.
It is indeed very cold, especially now, and the temperature is decreasing at the moment. We're expecting it's March time, but we're expecting even colder weather. Today it was -6, but felt like -12. People were lining in the queues since 9 a.m., since 8:30 a.m., because, you know, there is a curfew from 6 until 6 a.m. in the morning. So they had to, of course, to get to the train station somehow. So I spent some time until 3 p.m. approximately at the train station. People still were waiting to be set to some of the trains departing to the west. So the temperature is decreasing and the situation is not looking good.
I know that from Dnipro, where you are, you can see across the river to the city of Zaporizhia, where the power plant is held by Russian forces. Are you concerned about a nuclear incident?
Not in Zaporizhia. I went to Energodar. So this is Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in Energodar, the town that was taken by the Russians. And of course, that week when it happened, when the power nuclear power plant was taken, it was quite concerning because, you know, the control of two major nuclear power plants, like Chernobyl, infamous Chernobyl power plant, and Energodar, and the one in Energodar is very concerning. You know, probably you've seen today the reports that according to the Ukrainian intelligence, the Russians who are in control of the Chernobyl power plant, they're planning the terror act. Of course, it's according to Ukrainian officials, but you can imagine that we've already lived through this tragedy in 1986, so nobody wants this tragedy to repeat again.
Okay. Katerina, thank you very much for joining us this evening and giving us that update from the city of Dnipro, first attacked this morning for the first time. We're also going to be getting the view and what the situation, an update on the situation in Lviv from BBC's Fergal Keane a little later in the programme. Right now, though, we're staying with concerns about the possible use of chemical and biological weapons in the invasion of Ukraine. Hamish de Breton Gordon is a former commander of the UK's Joint Chemical, Biological, Radiological and Nuclear Regiment, and I spoke to him a little earlier on, and I began by asking him for a clarification. Is the development, production and deployment of chemical and biological weapons illegal under international law?
It is absolutely illegal under every international law, the Geneva Convention, the Chemical Weapons Convention. These dreadful weapons that were developed in the First World War were then outlawed, and in 1920 the Geneva Convention made them illegal, and they've been illegal ever since, and horrific weapons. Sadly, they started to be used in Syria, and in 2013, after the big attack in August that year, when the Obama red line disappeared in a puff of smoke, they then rather became a green light to every dictator, despot, rogue state and terrorist to use them. And I think that's why perhaps President Putin is thinking about using them in Ukraine.
And I might just bring you back then to what you're talking about there. So 2013, was that the first time they were used in Syria? Was that the first time they were used since they had been outlawed after the World War?
They'd been used a few times before, in the Iran-Iraq war in the 80s. And also in the late 80s, Saddam Hussein actually tried to exterminate the Kurdish race using chemical weapons. In one very infamous event in the 14th of March, 1988, at a town called Halabja, he dropped a lot of chemical weapons on that town and killed 17,000 people. But those were the only events. It was then in Syria when there were a few minor uses of chemical weapons in early 2013, and then the massive attack in August 2013, which killed over 1,500 people. That's when they became commonplace, and that's when the British government and the American government very sadly decided not to punish President Assad for using chemical weapons. And then they sort of proliferated and became much more common use, not just by states like Syria, but also by terror groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
And when you say the US and the UK decided not to punish Assad for the use of chemical weapons, and you mentioned Obama's red line, in advance of the use of those chemical weapons, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, had said that is a red line. If they cross that line, there will be retaliation. Is that correct? And then that didn't happen.
That's entirely correct. And I think that is really the root of a lot of the problems we're seeing now. I think particularly President Putin of Russia, the idea that the international community didn't have the stomach for a fight, didn't want to get involved in any of Russia's expansionist ideas. And, Putin thinks we're all weak anyway and won't do anything, which is why he's marched into Ukraine, because things aren't going well conventionally. His tanks seem to be breaking down. His troops have very bad morale. That's why people like myself, who have seen these things at first hand in Syria, think that President Putin might well go to use chemical weapons now, because they were so successful in Syria. And, of course, the international community turned a blind eye.
I believe that you believe that Bashar al-Assad is still ruler of Syria because of his use of chemical weapons. Can you explain to me why you think that?
I think he's entirely still in place because he used chemical weapons. Although these weren't exactly Russian chemical weapons, the Russians did give Assad the technology and the wherewithal to develop his chemical stockpile. He was about to fall, that's Assad was, in August 2013. He was about to be overrun by the rebels. He obviously didn't think that the West would take any action, and we didn't. So he stayed in power and then used chemical weapons on a number of occasions when the rebels looked like they might overthrow him. So absolutely, I think he's still in power because he used chemical weapons.
In terms of Russia's use of chemical weapons, then, as you say, they gave Syria the technology as opposed to the weapons themselves. To what extent have Russia, as a country, as a nation, used chemical weapons before the invasion of Ukraine?
Well, I live in a town called Salisbury in southern England, and the Russians authorised a chemical weapons attack there in March 2018. So that's the most, I suppose, visible use of chemical weapons that we've seen from the Russians. They declared to the United Nations in 2017 that they had no chemical weapons and they'd got rid of them. You know, that clearly was a falsehood. And we think they have quite a comprehensive program now. And threats to use them in Ukraine must be taken very, very seriously. I think not only because these weapons are morbidly brilliant and quite apart from keeping Assad in power, he fought conventionally in a city called Aleppo, which is about the same size as Kyiv, for 4 years and got nowhere, but then used chemical weapons on 13 days in December 2016 and defeated the rebels and the civilians surrendered. And he did the same again 2 years later. So these weapons can be really effective, but they are absolutely completely illegal and mainly affect civilians who have no gas masks to protect themselves.
Today, the UN Security Council is going to be holding an emergency meeting at the request of the Kremlin to discuss the alleged manufacture of chemical weapons in Ukraine. Now, from your sources, is there any truth to this claim that Ukraine is manufacturing biological weapons?
No, it's absolutely ridiculous. It would be laughable if it wasn't such a terrible subject. There is no way that Ukraine has been developing biological weapons. This seems another part of the false flag, the false claims that Russia is making about chemical and biological weapons, because when it does that in Syria, generally it means it's about to do an attack itself and then it will blame the other side. So I think there's absolutely no foundation at all in that claim, and hopefully the UN will kick it out for the ridiculous notion that it is.
And on that point, and given everything that you've said, how likely do you think it is at this point that Russia is going to start using weapons such as you've described in Ukraine?
Well, I think it is worryingly likely, actually. The conventional campaign, Putin's campaign into Ukraine, is going very badly. He's losing thousands of tanks. Lots of soldiers are being killed. I think once the Russians see the Russian population see body bags heading back towards Moscow, they're going to lose faith in Putin and get rid of him. You know, he's at a critical stage. He knows if he used chemical weapons, he could subdue the population of Ukraine and take Ukraine relatively quickly. And he gauges that the international community is not going to react in any demonstrable fashion. So on that basis, sadly, I think it is quite likely in the next sort of few weeks or months.
That was Hamish Gordon speaking to me a short time ago.